Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Tuesday, September 3rd. I'm Lisa Music reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Humboldt's Child Welfare Services workers recognized by Soups. PG&E hosts community pop-ups to discuss frequent power outages affecting Mattole Watershed residents. And new prescription drug cap for Medicare means big savings. Stay tuned. News on those stories and more coming right up. Humboldt's Child Welfare Services workers have been recognized for their dedication and compassion. Daniel Mintz reports.
Humboldt's Board of Supervisors has lauded the department that does some of the county's most challenging work. The work of the Child Welfare Services, or CWS, division was recognized in a resolution approved at the August 27th Supervisors meeting. The discussion included references to recent criticisms, including a grand jury report that found CWS court filings are often late. But Board Chair Rex Bone, who sponsored the resolution, said CWS caseworkers are dedicated and hardworking. He said, quote, "Are there issues? Yeah. You want to know why there's issues? Because they never close, they're operating 24/7, and they're there when they get called." Department of Health and Human Services Assistant Director Michelle Stevens said CWS social workers deal with trauma and in so doing experience it themselves.
I started in DHHS as a social worker in emergency response, and I will tell you that I feel like arguably child welfare work is the hardest area of social work practice because of the inherent conflict of wanting to be a helper and help children and families, but also having the profound responsibility of assessing child safety and having to remove children when it's warranted. Secondary trauma is a real experience. Many of us have experienced that. And it's difficult. There's inherent conflict between the work that we do and how families are impacted by that. It's traumatic for everybody, including children and the social workers that are involved.
Coral Sanders, the county's chief probation officer, said CWS social workers deal with families facing unimaginable difficulties and experience vicarious trauma, but are dedicated to their work. Jean Gordon, executive director of court-appointed special advocates of Humboldt, said that work is complicated by multiple challenges.
What I've learned over my 25 years in this space is that working with children and families involved in the foster care system is tireless work that is grounded in the desire to help others and make a difference in the community. I also know that each child and family has their own unique story, strengths, and needs. It takes heart and grit on the part of social workers and providers to show up for families in such a vulnerable, chaotic, and uncertain time in their lives. As a public entity, Child Welfare Services receives a high degree of scrutiny from the community that comes from a deep caring for fellow neighbors and doing the right thing for children. Having worked in this field for so long, I also understand that no system is perfect, and many of the challenges we face here in Humboldt County aren't unique to us. Like other counties across the state, there's a shortage of social workers, and there aren't nearly enough therapeutic mental health services or substance use treatment disorder centers available to support teens and parents. The state continuously places new mandates about best practices on counties and local governments, which only increases the workload and responsibilities of social workers. While these mandates are based on good intentions and a hopeful vision, there is no way that one social worker or one county agency can do it on their own, let alone do it well.
Humboldt District Attorney Stacy Eads said CWS caseworkers are driven by their compassion.
Everyone that joins CWS is a giver and a helper, and they put their hearts into it. There are, as other speakers have mentioned, a number of mandates and requirements. Confidentiality certainly is one of the biggest challenges, not being able to come forward and share everything that you might know that might be pertinent to a particular situation. And the secondary trauma is something that really requires all of these helpers and givers to truly give a part of their heart and the work that they do. So I'm very grateful that the board brought this forward and grateful for the work that Child Welfare Services does. I also want to highlight that from the district attorney's office specifically, we're really grateful for the collaborative work that we do together with child welfare services. We do work specifically addressing the commercial sexual exploitation of children. So the CSEC team, that's very active within the child welfare services, very important work, the sexual trafficking of children, addressing those problems that are very real here in Humboldt County.
Danielle Vickman, a detective with the county's sheriff's office, said county families and children experience trauma, need help, and quote, without child welfare services, some of these kids would be overlooked. They would not get the assistance they need. Bone said CWS handles 3,300 cases per year and was ranked number one in the state for timely investigations in the month of July. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
Pacific Gas and Electric is holding two community pop-ups to discuss the frequent outages that occur on a weekly basis for residents from Whitethorn to Petrolia. According to Megan McFarland, spokesperson with PG&E, the outages are due to the enhanced power line safety settings.
My name is Megan McFarland, and I'm a spokesperson for PG&E. So PG&E has been preparing for wildfire season. One of the things that we've done is, it was actually back in May, that we activated our enhanced power line safety settings in all the high fire threat districts. So these are advanced safety settings on our overhead power lines, and they automatically turn off power within 1/10 of a second if a hazard hits one of our lines. These settings are activated in the high fire risk areas and surrounding areas, and there was actually a 68% reduction in ignitions on EPSS-enabled lines. So they're a really important wildfire safety tool for our customers.
Following an object hitting the line, PG&E checks the lines for damage before restoring power. Patrols are done by helicopter, truck, or on foot, typically during daylight hours. However, in a heavily forested area like Whitethorn, outages have been occurring at least once a week since July due to the region's designation as a high fire threat district.
Yes. So these EPSS settings make the power line more sensitive. So it shuts down power right away when a tree branch or a hazard or anything comes in contact with the line. Before these EPSS settings were enabled, something would hit the line and then it would sort of relay kind of like a circuit breaker in your home and it would make sure nothing was in the line and then kind of come back on. But now as this added precaution, it shuts down the line. And then PG&E crews have to patrol the entire circuit to ensure that no damage or hazards are present. So we'll get out there on foot. We'll use helicopters, drones, aerial patrols, and sometimes we'll bring in extra crews to help with the patrols. But the only kind of flip side of the EPSS settings is that we have to patrol this line, so there can be more frequent outages that last a little bit longer.
While no one wants to see a wildfire in their neighborhood, the community of Whitethorn is frustrated by the frequent outages.
When I hear the words PG&E or power outage, I get a little angry.
That was Anna Rogers, a longtime resident of Whitethorn.
We live in a very rural area and we cannot seem to get reliable power or telephone service, which are basic needs.
Rogers explained that the outages are negatively impacting vulnerable community members.
It's really hard to find answers when we have questions and when we aren't getting the services that we need and that we pay for. We have a lot of people out here who live alone, who are elderly, have no cell service, and can't get basic services or information or response from these large corporations.
She believes that a corporation whose CEO, Patricia Pope, took home $17 million in the 2023 fiscal year should be using the funds to create common sense solutions instead of corporate payouts.
I do understand that it's related to fire safety, to preventing fires, but the way that they're handling it is not satisfactory. It seems like when these outages happen, it's because of a sensor that is tripped by anything touching the line. And they can't turn the power back on until they've investigated it. I understand that. But they're shutting the power off from Lower Redway all the way to Petrolia. That is an entire watershed. That is the entire Middle Watershed plus some of the Eel Watershed. That is a huge area to shut off when a branch might touch one power line.
Rogers, like many others in Whitethorn, is also employed locally. And when the power goes out, they are also losing a portion of their paycheck.
There has to be a better way. We have had 9 outages in August, and it's severely impacting people's lives, their work. It's impacted my work. People lose food when the power goes out for long amounts of time. That's money down the drain, and we're not getting rebates from the company for these. You know, some people have generators. Not everybody. I don't have a generator. My office doesn't have a generator. So what do we do, you know, when that keeps happening? It's like literally every week, twice a week. How do you function? How do you get your work done? How do you get your life done? there's a limit to how much we can accomplish when the power keeps going out. It's kind of ridiculous.
Megan McFarlane with PG&E says the company understands residents' frustration, but explained that their enhanced power line safety settings prevent extended outages like those seen in 2020 with the PSPSs.
So EPSS, these enhanced power line safety settings are definitely, you know, an important tool in helping PG&E prevent wildfires. One of the benefits is that it has reduced the number of public safety power shutoffs we needed. That's when we do sort of a widespread shutdown of power while there's different factors in the area that could create wildfire conditions. So EPSS is definitely a valuable tool for us.
But residents like Rogers want more answers and will be attending the PG&E pop-up in Garberville on Thursday, September 5th.
I hope to hear that they are going to install more sensors or that they have some other plan that I don't know about coming, because I feel like this practice of shutting off, you know, 60 miles or more of power lines is unreasonable. But people are paying for power and they're not getting power. The success of a corporation can be marked by how they treat their smallest customer or their smallest service area. And I'm just not seeing them treat us as if we matter out here in Whitethorn and the surrounding areas, you know, Ettersburg, Bryceland, Petrolia.
In closing, she encourages others impacted by the frequent outages to visit the pop-up together to have a collective voice.
I think it would be best if Whitethorn and Ettersburg, anybody who's affected by this that lives here in the Upper Mattole area, I understand that Petrolia is having their meeting tomorrow, but there is this meeting on Thursday in Garberville. I would like to see everybody in Soham that's been affected by these outages come right at the beginning. Let's make it a community meeting and not one-on-one. And really see if we can voice our concerns and if they'll listen to us and what plan they have in place.
PG&E says its events are designed to allow customers to meet with PG&E experts, discuss recent power outages, and learn about safety settings and efforts to improve electric reliability. PG&E will be hosting a community pop-up event on Wednesday, September 4th from 4 to 6 p.m. at the Petrolia General Store parking lot located at 40 Sherman Road in Petrolia. And also on Thursday, September 5th from 4 to 6 p.m. at the Pacific Gas and Electric Service Center parking lot located at 1328 Redwood Drive in Garberville. Turning to Mendocino, the new executive director of the Mendocino Art Center outlines his vision for the center's future, emphasizing regeneration, inclusivity, and exciting new programs alongside beloved traditions. KZYX's Michelle Blackwell reports.
It has been a tumultuous period for the iconic institution that has defined the village of Mendocino since the 60s. The Mendocino Arts Center, founded by the Zacas, is largely considered the driving force that created both the arts community and the current economy on the Central Coast. While the center has had good and bad times, the pandemic significantly impacted its ability to provide the services it was well known for in Mendocino and beyond. Along with its financial woes, the Arts Center has gone through multiple executive directors in recent years. Dav Bell, an artist, ecologist, former firefighter, and park ranger, is taking on the role. Bell studied art in Spain and holds art degrees from UCLA and UC Santa Cruz. He also co-founded and directed the Greenhouse Project in Santa Cruz. Bell is here with us today to talk about the current status of the center and his plans for its future. How did you hear about the Mendocino Art Center and what drew you to our area?
Yeah, so I actually heard about the position through a mentor of mine when I was studying at UC Santa Cruz. Her name was Lori Palmer, and she's actually someone who's joining our board, which is really amazing. It becomes this kind of full circle. She had a lot of connections up here.
How stable are the Art Center's finances today, and what are your plans in that regard?
Yeah, I came with buckets, but the job actually was really appealing to me because of its struggling status. And like, I was warned about the finances coming in, but it also kind of provided an opportunity to build something new. And that was what was really exciting to me. Yeah, we're still operating with bare minimum staff. We could use double the amount of staff we have right now. Finances are still hard, but something we just launched a couple of weeks ago is called the Regenerative Future Fund. And it's trying to look at the Art Center in an expansive way instead of thinking of like it through emergency. I mean, coming out of COVID, I say out of lightly, it's harder and harder to find donors and people that want to support spaces because they've been bailing people out for years now. So thinking of it in this regenerative sense has been kind of like what we've been thinking about. Like, how do we work with community members? How do we as an art center go out into the community and support and help other organizations? And how do we come together as organizations to sustain ourselves?
Several programs have been cut in recent years, including the jewelry and textiles programs. Have those been restored? And if not, are there plans to do so?
We have plans to restore the jewelry department, but right now it's operating on a volunteer basis. And also you can rent the studio, you can still come in and run your own class. As far as the textile department goes, I would love to see this revamped. And I think there's so many amazing textile artists throughout this coast that we'd love to bring in, and also people from out of state that would love to come in. So it's really about just finding the resources to do so.
The Artist in Residence program has been an opportunity to bring diversity and creativity to the coast. What are your plans for the program?
Well, we just launched the Greenhouse Project residency. So it's a collaboration with the space that I opened in Santa Cruz. And we've had a huge amount of responses. This would launch in the wintertime, and it is centering art, food, and climate justice. It really has a focus on bringing in a diverse group of not just artists, but foragers, researchers, social practice artists, as well as painters, ceramicists. And so it's a pretty opened application in terms of what you can do, but all of it kind of centers around climate resilience. And so, yeah, the response has just been overwhelming, to say the least. And so building this type of programming and residencies throughout the year is kind of my dream.
Does it take up a significant part of the budget?
It does, yeah. I mean, just to have staff to run these programs is a huge part of what we have to do right now. So bringing anything new is difficult, but it's also very necessary because otherwise we just have empty rooms. It's a passion project already. And I've really fallen in love with Mendocino and the people of Mendocino already enough to be like, okay, it's been 4 months, but I can, you know, I find myself really wanting to be here and work with people here.
The Open Paintout is a very popular program. Will it continue?
Yeah. MOPA was one of the first events that I had seen when I looked on the website when I was thinking about applying to the job. And I was super excited about it. And I had knew nothing about it. It's not from the background that I'm from. When I talk to the founders about it and they mention, you know, just some of the language around it, and I'm like, what's that? And they're just like, oh, you're really new to this. But I find it to be really exciting. I mean, we have almost a full roster for this year. We're bringing in the local high school to bring their students in to shadow some of the painters that have been coming for years.
So what day is it?
September 16th to the 21st. The 26th will be the public event where everyone can come and we'll have music and food, and everyone can come and buy the paintings and see what everyone's been working on for the week.
The Art Center at one point regularly hosted the big band on the lawn, the local big band, held art fairs, added programs for local youth. Where do those types of outreach programs stand today?
I think these are the two things that I get poked in town about the most, and they've been kind of the thing that I haven't understood where they existed in the past, because I think there has been a break, but people are constantly like, when are you bringing that back? What about the fair? What about that thing that you guys do? And I think it goes along with our need to find funders and community support in order to bring these things back. In terms of programs for the local youth, we just began this Decolonize Open Mic Night that was started by Tatum Starr, who is from Hakakadile Farm, the indigenous-led, woman-led farm, and Sarah Ting, to create a space for young artists, BIPOC artists and LGBTQ plus artists to have a safe space to express, tell their stories, play music. And we hosted the first one a couple weeks ago, and it was just absolutely amazing. So we'll be announcing really soon the next one.
For KZOX News, I'm Michelle Blackwell.
In state news, clean energy advocates and state lawmakers gathered at a hydrogen fueling station near the Port of Oakland to celebrate a $1.2 billion deal to create a statewide clean hydrogen hub. Pacifica Radio's Chloe Behrens.
The collaboration between the Alliance for Renewable Clean Hydrogen Energy Systems, a public-private renewable energy organization, and the U.S. Department of Energy will advance clean hydrogen projects across the state of California and seek to slash harmful emissions in the state. The project will fund fleets of hydrogen-powered trucks and buses, the construction of pipelines and fueling stations across the state, and the creation of hydrogen liquefaction facilities. Angelina Galativa is the CEO of the Alliance for Renewable Clean Hydrogen Energy Systems, or ARCHES. She said the project will see returns year after year, both in benefits to the state economy as well as to community health.
We have a program that will result in over 200,000 new jobs in California created by ARCHES, as well as a reduction in cost of $2.96 billion on an annual basis year after year. So this hub will pay for itself in making sure that we have healthcare savings for our communities. So today's launch marks this transformative moment for California's clean energy revolution.
The project is a part of California's efforts to realize a carbon-neutral economy. Last year, California air regulators passed a first-of-its-kind mandate to discontinue the sale of new diesel big rig trucks statewide by 2036 and force large trucking companies to switch their fleets to hydrogen or electric power vehicles by 2042. Trucking and agricultural companies who oppose the ban claim zero-emission vehicles are far more costly to buy and maintain. And they say the deadlines for converting their fleets are unreachable. According to the California Air Resources Board, one measure to regulate shipping container trucks at city ports is already delayed. Senator Alex Padilla said the agreement with ARCHES will address the challenges in the heavy transportation sector.
Promise ARCHES offers is one that not everybody always thinks about, right? It's easy to think about maybe passenger cars or some of the ferries that we rode on earlier today, but think heavy duty transportation, one of the toughest nuts to crack when it comes to a clean energy transition and other heavy industries. So we're making huge steps towards these ambitious goals of making the entire state of California carbon neutral.
California Governor Gavin Newsom said California is leading the nation in clean energy. According to Newsom, a low-carbon agenda was historically a bipartisan issue, and the funding for the ARCHES project was made possible by a bipartisan law, the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, signed by President Biden in 2021.
It was about common sense, clean air, clean water. It was about a mindset of sustainability, not a situational mindset. It wasn't about extraction. Of course, we're here quite literally because of a bipartisan bill, the Infrastructure Act. $1.2 trillion, $550 billion of additional resources that have allowed the resources to flow, 1.2 of those billion to the state of California in this catalytic endeavor.
$30 million has already been deployed in the first phase of the California project. In addition to the $1.2 billion contract, the DOE pledged $62 million more towards projects to accelerate hydrogen fueling research and development across 15 states in the country. For KPFA News, I'm Chloe Behrens in West Oakland.
Gun control advocates and Democrats gathered at the state capitol to call for the swift passage of legislation they say will save lives and make it harder to obtain firearms on the black market. KPFA's Christina Onnestad brings you the details.
There's some people who should be saying Thankful Thursday. They're not. They're not here. And those people are connected to my DNA.
Assemblyman Mike Gibson, a Democrat of Southern California, is among the families of loved ones impacted by gun violence. The former policeman's son was hit in a drive-by shooting in 2020. The bullet fractured his rib and pierced his lung. His fiancée was hit in the leg. Their friend was killed.
Whoever would have thought that myself would have answered the door to gun violence to my own family? You see, this is personal. This is personal. So that's why I support all gun legislation that my colleagues come up with. This is why that we beat the head of the NRA every chance we get to making sure that no more individuals die in our city, in our state, in our counties.
Gibson authored a law cracking down on ghost guns, untraceable firearms, and is among the Democrats, along with Moms Demand Action, to speak in support of two new bills they want to send to Governor Gavin Newsom before a Saturday deadline. One would close loopholes that allow for the resale of firearms confiscated by law enforcement or obtained through gun buyback programs. San Mateo Assemblymember Democrat Diane Pepin introduced AB 2842, and Senate Democrat Catherine Blakespear of Oceanside introduced the companion bill.
Many parts of guns that are collected in such gun buyback programs end up being resold online as parts of gun kits. And those are then easily turned into ghost guns. Unwanted guns promised to be destroyed and confiscated wind up back on the streets. This is just completely unacceptable. SB 1019 makes the law clear that the entire gun must be destroyed. Because of how the law presently defines a firearm, guns that were legally destroyed were considered destroyed when all the things that make a gun, like the barrel, grip, slide, firing pin, and magazine, were not demolished under the current law.
Blakespear of Southern California also touted her legislation, SB 1002, to beef up the enforcement of a state law mandating people who undergo mental health holds relinquish their firearms. There are some 4,800 of these Californians who've refused to do so, according to the State Justice Department.
It gives individuals a clear deadline of 72 hours after discharge from the healthcare facility to turn over their firearms. It provides law enforcement the information they need to investigate who those people are and then to coordinate with the Department of Justice. And it directs the healthcare facilities to inform the individuals how to relinquish their weapons. Because if you're told you have to relinquish it, but you don't know how to do it, then you might decide you don't want to do it at all.
Both bills are expected to pass their final vote in the legislature before reaching the governor's desk. California has some of the most toughest gun control laws in the country. Yet between the years 2013 and 2022, it recorded nearly 32,000 gun-related deaths. That's among the lowest per capita. States like Texas and Florida, which have lax gun control laws, have among the highest per capita gun death rate, according to the California Department of Justice. I'm Christina Onnested, reporting for KPFA.
In national news, Medicare enrollees will not have to spend more than $2,000 annually on prescription drugs starting next year. Suzanne Potter reports.
Hundreds of thousands of older Californians will see huge savings on prescription drugs starting in January, according to a new report from AARP. The Biden administration's Inflation Reduction Act caps prescription drug costs at $2,000 per year for people on Medicare, starting in 2025. Nina Weiler-Harwell with AARP says an estimated 271,000 people in the Golden State will hit the out-of-pocket maximum next year.
Medicare drug plan enrollees nationwide who reach the new out-of-pocket cap will see an average savings of roughly $1,500 or 56% in 2025 for new prescription drugs.
On average, 40% of people on Medicare who reach the cap will save at least $1,000 a year, and 12% will see savings of more than $3,000. Every year from 2025 to 2029, between 3 and 4 million Part D plan enrollees are estimated to benefit from the new out-of-pocket cap. Weiler-Harwell says the Inflation Reduction Act introduced a number of new policies to cut costs for Americans on Medicare.
Copays for insulin capped at $35 a month. Vaccines such as shingles and pneumonia are free. The Inflation Reduction Act did allow Medicare to negotiate the price of high-cost prescription drugs, so we won't really start to do that until 2026.
Also, thanks to the IRA, drug companies will have to pay a penalty if they raise their prices higher than inflation. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mentz, Michelle Blackwell, Christina Onnested, Chloe Behrens, and Suzanne Potter. Reporting from the KMUD studio in Redway, I'm Lisa Music.